You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products. Because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
There's a lot happening these days. But I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters, without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Hey, it's Andy, Mike, and Jason of the Fantasy Footballers Podcast here, and we're inviting you to join us live on NFL Plus following the first round of the NFL draft. Look, fantasy football, let's be honest, gentlemen, it kind of rules the world.
That's right, and we will be live with in-the-moment fantasy football reactions to all the first-round selections and all the craziest surprises. We never can predict what's going to happen on that first day of the NFL draft.
Lots of elite talent at the skill positions that will have a big impact on fantasy football this year. Are we going to get 3 wide receivers in the top 10? Are we going to break the record for the most wide receivers in the first round? Is there going to be a running back? I don't know.
And there's a lot of teams like the Chiefs, the Bills. We're really excited about their quarterback. Do they add a wide receiver? What are some of those best landing spots?
The Fantasy Footballers Draft Special will air exclusively on NFL Plus on Thursday, April 25th, following the conclusion of the first round of the draft. Go to plus.nfl.com to sign up today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Coin Bureau podcast is a production of iHeartRadio. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the new Wednesday edition of the Coin Bureau podcast. For these weekly episodes, I've picked out 2 of my favorite videos from Coin Bureau's YouTube channel to present to you in podcast form. The audio you're about to hear is from those videos I've chosen this week. Many of you have been in touch to ask whether it's possible to listen to our videos in podcast format, and so your wish is my command. This week, I've chosen our videos on the unfolding crisis in Sri Lanka and the bank runs recently witnessed in China. I've chosen these 2 because they deal with macroeconomic issues that will impact upon the wider global economy, even though they appear on the surface to be merely localized problems. For those of us who watch the crypto markets closely, it's important to remember that factors beyond crypto itself can affect prices too. Our globalized world is often bound more tightly together than we might think. Both videos were fascinating to research, and I hope you enjoy listening to them. I'll be back talking crypto with Mike very soon, so be sure to stay tuned. And if you want even more content from Coin Bureau, be sure to visit our YouTube channel and visit us on social media too. In these times of economic uncertainty, it's not the news stories that are being covered that need to be focused on, but those that aren't. And when some stories are suppressed by the powers that be, you know they've got to be big. Right now, there are things going on that could be the proverbial canaries in the economic coal mine. And one of these canaries is Chinese bank runs. In this video, I'm going to tell you exactly why you need to be keeping a very close eye on this little birdie. Now, if this is the first time that you're hearing about Chinese bank runs, then that's probably by design. China is not a country that's well known for its transparency, and protests of any kind are routinely suppressed. This year has seen some particularly brutal suppression, given that it's the year of the 20th Party Congress and Xi Jinping wants no disruptions to a smooth transition into his unprecedented third term. But over the past 3 months, there have been several bank runs taking place across China. Bank runs on smaller rural banks where an estimated $1.5 billion worth of deposits have been lost. But before diving into the runs themselves, it's important to have a brief understanding of China's banking landscape. It helps to understand exactly how we got here and why it's such a precarious situation. Basically, in China, there are thousands of small rural banks that are meant to serve only the local population. If we include the slightly larger commercial rural banks, the total number of banks that fall into this category numbers over 3,800. They hold assets to the equivalent of about $300 billion, around 12% of total banking assets in China. Structurally, you can think of these banks as akin to credit unions in the United States. However, there are supposed to be strict limits on who is allowed to open accounts at these banks. In China, such banks are not allowed to expand outside of their locality. The role that these banks are supposed to play is simple: to support the local economy of small farmers and small to medium-sized enterprises. The problem is that these banks were, obviously, highly dependent on the local economy. Moreover, as increasing numbers of people migrate away from rural areas to the cities, the customer base of these banks starts to shrink. And if there is one thing that China has been known for over the past 10 years, it is rapid urbanization. Millions of people have indeed moved to the cities. The natural result of this was a loss of customers for these banks, and because they could not expand out of their localities, they needed to find a way to bring in more customers. As such, they started to turn their attention to attracting more customers through online platforms, sometimes those who lived beyond the bank's catchment areas. While this was technically illegal, the rules were not being enforced. And in order to entice these customers to bring their funds to the banks, they advertised higher interest rates with flexible terms. What could go wrong? This led many out-of-towners to invest their money in these banks through these online lending platforms. They didn't expect this to be a risky investment. That's because, unlike prior P2P loan scandals in China, these were banks. People always trusted that their money would be available to them, thanks to government deposit insurance schemes. Anyways, as the People's Bank of China, PBOC, continued with its lax monetary policy, interest rates in the economy continued to decline. For example, Bank of China, one of China's big four state-owned banks, offered interest rates of 2.75% on a five-year fixed deposit. So, when you have a rural bank that's offering you rates of between 4.1% and 4.5%, it's particularly alluring. This meant more and more people continued to deposit their funds into these banks through their online platforms. Now, the only problem is that in order to keep generating those returns, the banks have to start taking on progressively more risk. And stop me if you've heard this one before. As a bank, this means that you have to start giving out loans to companies and people who are less than creditworthy. And in China, there were a lot of these companies, and they were taking out a shitload of loans, particularly in the property sector, something I'll come back to in a bit. So, this was the lay of the land in the Chinese rural banking sector. However, things took a turn for the worse in April this year. At about the same time that China was going into broad and brutal lockdowns, people who had invested at these rural banks began to learn that they didn't have access to their funds. On the 18th of April, four rural banks in Henan province froze deposits, totaling about 10 billion yuan, nearly 1.5 billion USD. In this Reuters story from back then, depositors at the bank said that they had been communicating with each other via WeChat as to how they could retrieve their funds. At the time, the South China Morning Post spoke to half a dozen depositors who said they had not been able to withdraw funds, either online or in person, with total deposits ranging from 200,000 yuan to over 1.5 million yuan, 29k USD to 220k USD. According to this man in Shanghai, quote, "My friend recommended the bank, saying it had high interest rates. I can't access the app right now." There was also ambiguity as to whether the deposits with these banks were backed by the banking regulator, which further added to the confusion and anger. As more and more of these stories spread, people decided that they were going to protest at these banks. Images started to emerge of citizens outside the local office of the China Banking and Insurance Regulatory Commission in Zhengzhou City. They were carrying signs that read, "Return my savings," and other perfectly reasonable demands. Of course, being China, news of the protests was heavily suppressed. Protesters were, quote, "pushed around by the local police with brute force" and were blocked from entering the city. But, perhaps most dystopian of all, citizens who were thought to be travelling into a city to protest had their COVID green passes mysteriously turn red when they arrived at city checkpoints. Now, in a country like China, having a red COVID pass means being sent to a government-mandated quarantine facility. Can't imagine that is much fun. Some protesters were escorted to these facilities by armed guards. Others were detained and then sent out of the city on returning trains. However, the moment that they got back to their home provinces, their COVID passes just as mysteriously turned green again. Just wait until they link up those passes to the CBDC China is rolling out. Anyways, despite these measures, the protests didn't stop. In fact, they got bigger. Now, I'd just like to give a quick shout out to all those new viewers out there today. If this is the first time that you're watching Coin Bureau, my name is Guy, and on this channel, we cover everything you just have to know, from finance to crypto and global macro. We're unsponsored and don't run ads, so you can get the most impartial and unimpeded viewing experience. If that's something you want more of, then I would really appreciate it if you could give me a subscribe. Ping that bell as well to make sure that YouTube will give you a bell as well when a new video is served. Okay, back to our scheduled program. In mid-July, more than 1,000 people staged a protest outside the Zhengzhou branch of the PBOC. This was one of the largest protests since the pandemic began, and it's safe to say that the government did not like it. That's why they sent in the police and other security personnel. Many of them were in plain clothes as they descended on the protesters. People were violently beaten and taken away for peacefully protesting the loss of access to their frozen funds. These scenes played out on the news and, despite the best attempts at censorship, were also shared on local messaging apps like WeChat. In the days after the protests, the government claimed that they had arrested members of a criminal gang that was responsible for the crisis. They claimed that the gang had taken control over the Henan banks and leveraged their shareholdings by, quote, "manipulating bank executives." When it came to those who had deposited their funds with the banks, the government said that it would partially be covering these deposits with a compensation plan. The plan promises to cover those who had deposits of up to 50,000 yuan, about $7,500. Of course, this didn't help all those depositors who had larger sums with the banks. There were vague promises about them being able to reclaim more later, but they would have been of little consolation to those whose life savings were tied up in institutions they thought were fully creditworthy. But the real concern here is not what happened to these four rural banks, but whether the fear could spread to many other rural banks. Remember that there are close to 3,800 of such institutions, and they hold a gargantuan amount in deposits. What happens if the stories of these depositors who lost their life savings start to permeate out? What happens if other people in the country start to grow edgy about their deposits and therefore decide that it's best to just withdraw first and ask questions later? The reason why bank runs are so deadly is because often it's merely the rumor of a bank run that can cause one. People will rush to the bank to withdraw, and this will cause the bank to have a liquidity crunch. If they don't have the cash on hand, then it means that they will have to restrict withdrawals. This creates even more panic, and so on. There's also no guarantee that the panic will be contained to only the rural banks. In this climate of uncertainty, in a country not known for transparency, cash is king. The main question now is whether the banks in China remain well capitalized enough to be able to pay out withdrawal requests. Well, yeah, about that. You see, China is going through a pretty rough economic patch at the moment, and that's not because of rural banks, which promised high returns. One of the biggest risks to the Chinese economy is those over-leveraged property developers. Now, I talked about this in much greater detail last year when I covered the Evergrande situation, linked to below. But since then, things have only gotten worse. Now, because it's hard to get a reading of the credit distress within the country, it helps to take a look at the offshore bond market. As you no doubt know, Evergrande defaulted on its dollar bonds earlier this year, and it seems as if the trend is only going in one direction. So far this year, bond delinquencies have already exceeded $26 billion. And the rot has begun to spread to other, much larger property developers. Here you can see the dollar bond prices of some of China's largest developers. These include the likes of Country Garden and Vanke, both of which have almost double the sales of Evergrande. These are tanking, which means that there is renewed skepticism about the potential for these developers to be able to pay their debts going forward. While the Evergrande default could have been absorbed, a collapse of these two other developers could have cataclysmic results for the economy. And while these are offshore bonds, you should also not forget that these developers have immense onshore debt as well. The holders of this debt are the banks in China that have lent to the developers. There are also a number of other businesses that hold opaque commercial paper issued by these developers. These include not just banks, but suppliers, contractors, and other businesses that operate in the construction supply chain. Here's the crazy thing, though. Because this commercial paper has been seen as an asset, it has also been used as collateral and a quasi-currency. Banks would give out loans to businesses that held this commercial paper on the assumption that it was as good as cash. I mean, for a property developer in a country with a rock-solid real estate sector, banks were more than willing to hold this on their balance sheets. The only problem is that this commercial paper is not cash. And when people are demanding their deposits back, they don't really want to get commercial paper. So banks could find themselves in a precarious position where they have a balance sheet that's deteriorating by the day and demands from their creditors, their depositors, for their funds back. This is an issue which would extend far beyond just the rural banks to include the likes of the larger commercial banks in the country. But if you think that's where the problems end for Chinese banks, then I hate to break it to you, but they are exposed not only to the developers that built these homes, but also those people who bought said homes from the developers. Given that property has been seen as one of the best investments over the past few years, Chinese citizens have been snapping it up. Many were more than happy to put down a deposit on an apartment that didn't yet exist. They also had no qualms about buying these apartments with debt and taking out mortgages. Their thinking was that as long as the prices went up and demand was there, they could always flip at a profit and pay off the debt. The banks had a similar thinking as to the collateral value of the homes and were therefore happy to issue mortgages. The only problem is that because these property developers have been in trouble, there have been substantial delays to some of these projects. In some cases, people were delivered half-built houses. In other cases, they had nothing delivered at all. Now, it also doesn't help that home prices have been falling across the board in China. So, what you had was a situation where people were paying a mortgage for a home they didn't have access to, and which was also falling in value. To protest what many thought was an injustice, they also stopped paying their mortgages. Home buyers across 22 cities have refused to meet their payment obligations. This is putting a strain on bank balance sheets, as they don't earn that interest income which they can then use to pay out their depositors. It's also not as if they can take ownership of the houses because, well, they haven't even been built. So essentially, you have a dire situation in which banks are being squeezed in all directions. They're exposed to the developers. They are exposed to the home buyers. They're exposed to everyone that has taken on commercial paper as debt. A bleak picture indeed. So it's perhaps for this reason that Chinese bank stocks have been taking a tumble. China's CSI Banks Index has fallen to a two-year low on these contagion fears. But at least they can count on some strong, robust economic growth, right? Well, last week, China reported its advanced estimates for Q2 GDP growth. This came in at 0.4%, and it was one of the slowest since the start of the pandemic. It was also way below the 4.8% recorded in Q1, and even below most analysts' estimates. Of course, that's if you even believe that in a time when the country had some of its most restrictive lockdowns in its biggest cities, it was somehow able to achieve any growth at all. I talked about this in much greater detail in my video about Chinese GDP, which I will pop in the description for you. Now, irrespective of what the true growth rate is, it's still a pretty unprecedented slowdown for the country. It also points to the fact that there are broader stresses in the country that extend beyond just the property sector. Stresses that could further add strains to bank balance sheets. Let's just hope they don't have a whole host of anxious depositors turning up at their branches demanding their money back all at once. Okay, time for a few closing thoughts on this mess. It's quite clear that China's economy is sailing through some stormy seas. Then again, nearly all economies are, but the difference is that we now know how high the waves are. Given the suppression of speech and manipulation of data in China, it's hard to tell whether its economy will be swamped by the waves it's trying to navigate. I also wouldn't expect any sort of transparency to be forthcoming. In fact, over the next couple of months, we're likely to see even further crackdowns on dissent and protests as Xi Jinping prepares for the 20th Party Congress. Can't have the news of economic turmoil spoiling the big party, can we? These bank runs are just a symptom of a larger issue that plagues China, a lack of transparency and an erosion of trust in the powers that be. The more the authorities attempt to suppress these stories, the more people will begin to worry about the safety of their savings. And of course, they have good reason to worry. That's because their savings have been loaned out, rehypothecated, and loaned out again. They may be tied up in some developer debt, or perhaps they went towards someone's mortgage. The banks are now struggling to recoup these funds, and their balance sheets are getting impacted in the process. China has a slowdown in economic growth, and there is no guarantee that we won't see a reversion to some draconian COVID measures, especially in the lead up to Xi's third term. It's going to be interesting to see how all this plays out. Either it turns out to be an economic tempest of titanic proportions, or nothing more than a storm in a teacup. Either way, it's something I am going to be keeping a very close eye on.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Hey, it's Andy, Mike, and Jason of the Fantasy Footballers Podcast here, and we're inviting you to join us live on NFL Plus following the first round of the NFL Draft. Look, fantasy football, let's be honest, gentlemen, it kind of rules the world.
That's right, and we will be live with in-the-moment fantasy football reactions to all the first-round selections and all the crazy surprises. We never can predict what's going to happen on that first day of the NFL draft.
Lots of elite talent at the skill positions that will have a big impact on fantasy football this year. Are we going to get 3 wide receivers in the top 10? Are we going to break the record for the most wide receivers in the first round? Is there going to be a running back? I don't know.
And there's a lot of teams like the Chiefs, the Bills. We're really excited about their quarterback. Do they add a wide receiver? What are some of those best landing spots?
The Fantasy Footballers Draft Special will air exclusively on NFL Plus on Thursday, April 25th, following the conclusion of the first round of the draft. Go to plus.nfl.com to sign up today. Terms and conditions apply.
When does economic hardship turn into revolution? When do people risk it all to overthrow the status quo? Tricky questions, but we can get some of our best answers yet from what's been happening in Sri Lanka. In my video today, I'm going to tell you exactly what's taken place so far and how the country got to where it is. I'll also go through some of the implications for other countries that could be in similarly precarious positions. This is a video you can't afford to miss. In case you've been living under a rock for the past couple of months, you'll have seen that Sri Lanka has been through a revolution. A revolution involving protests which eventually resulted in the presidential palace being stormed and the president, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, fleeing the country. Now, we'll get to all of that, but before we do, we need to take a look at Sri Lanka's recent history. In short, Sri Lanka has been ruled by one political family for almost 20 years. These are the Rajapaksas, who first came to power back in 2004. This was when Mahinda Rajapaksa, the elder brother of the now ex-president, was appointed prime minister. He was quite the populist and projected himself as the people's man. In 2005, he was elected president, and one of his primary goals was to put an end to the three-decade-long Sri Lankan civil war. He succeeded to this end and eventually crushed the Tamil resistance fighters in 2009. Now, despite what some people may think of this, the majority of the Sri Lankan population saw it as a victory for stability. And I should also add that, at about this time, Gotabaya was serving as a powerful military strategist and defense official. So, it was the role that the brothers played in ending the civil war that earned them the support of the broader majority Sinhalese population. Despite briefly losing power in 2015 to the opposition party, the brothers made a comeback in 2019. That was due to their promise of stability again in the wake of the Easter Day bombings, in which 250 people were killed, this time as a result of Islamic terror. This played well in a country scared of ISIS and with the civil war still fresh in its mind. And this time it was Gotabaya who eventually became president. He then appointed his brother, yes, the previous president, as prime minister. And he also handed key positions to several other members of his family. Never a good idea. That's because, with only loyalists and yes-men in the government, the president was never told that some of the ideas he had were just plain stupid. And if he was told, then the individual doing the telling was sacked. As a result, a lot of mistakes were made. One of the earliest of these, even before Gotabaya became president, was the reliance on Chinese debt to finance wasteful expenditure. These short-term loans came with onerous terms and were used to build things like an airport no one flies to and a cricket stadium no one uses. To a cricket-loving Brit, that second one really is beyond the pale. Anyways, total estimates for the outstanding Chinese loans are between $5 and $10 billion. This is on top of the other $51 billion owed to other nations. And, fun fact, in 2018, Sri Lanka defaulted on one of its loans to China and, as a result, had to sign over a strategic port in the south of the country to China on a 99-year lease. Now, part of the way in which Sri Lanka was able to service its debts and maintain a standard of living for its people was through one of its main sources of foreign income, tourism. And while the Easter Day bombings were a blow to the tourism sector, it was the pandemic that really reduced that particular income stream to a trickle. With the collapse of the tourism industry in Sri Lanka, the government was left facing a balance of payments crisis. Essentially, it was importing way more than it was exporting, and this meant that it had to restrict some of those imports or risk not being able to pay for them. One imported product upon which the country was most reliant was, of course, fuel. Sri Lanka imported nearly all of its fuel, and when funds started running dry, so too did the pumps. Fuel is, unsurprisingly, essential in Sri Lanka, not only for filling cars, but for generating power. Fuel cuts have resulted in months of rolling blackouts across the country. Even those able to afford the now expensive fuel had to spend hours or in some cases days waiting in line. The government was forced to impose rationing, though even this has not been enough to prevent shortages. While many were hopeful that more fuel would eventually arrive, the government's energy minister was forced to admit that there weren't the funds there to pay for it. The shipments would cost $587 million, but the government only had $125 million in the bank. It's also in debt to food suppliers to the tune of around $800 million. It's not only fuel, though, as there is also a shortage of cooking gas. This is essential for a lot of Sri Lankans who use it to cook in their homes and have had to resort to open fires to prepare their food. Of course, given that fuel is one of the biggest components of the cost of many goods and services, this has contributed to some pretty sky-high inflation. In June of this year, the government reported an inflation rate of 54.6%. This was compared to 29.8% that was reported in May. And that's if you even believe all of these official inflation figures that governments put out. Of course, the attempts to solve the country's balance of payment problems were all in vain. And that's because not only did the country not have enough dollars to import vital goods, it also didn't have enough in reserve to pay the interest on its outstanding sovereign debt. The result was the first sovereign debt default in Sri Lanka's history, something that completely tanked its credit rating and locked it out of any further financing. So, it's an altogether torrid time for the people of Sri Lanka. However, was it this fuel crisis that led to the protests? Was it the balance of payments crisis that caused people to take to the streets? Well, I don't think so. At least, not directly. The biggest catalyst has to be food shortages. When the choice is between arrest or potential death at a protest, it's still a better outcome than certain death from starvation. In Sri Lanka, people are struggling to find their next meal, and many are going hungry. Now, this seems counterintuitive for a country that seems to have abundant arable land and is a large producer of staples such as rice and vegetables. Well, these shortages are all thanks to some pretty ill-advised government environmental policy, the seeds of which were sown over a year ago. Allow me to explain. In April last year, the Sri Lankan government implemented a ban on synthetic fertilizers. The rationale for this ban was that these fertilizers could be harmful and that farmers should consider organic alternatives. I should also add that the movement to ban these fertilizers is worldwide, and one can only assume that the Sri Lankan government assumed it to be a sound environmental policy. Beyond that lay the hope that the ban would help to lessen the country's balance of payments problem by eliminating the $400 million that was being spent annually on these fertilizers. Remember this number, as we'll come back to it in a bit. Either way, nearly every farmer and industry expert told the government that this was a bad idea. If they were indeed looking to eventually transition to organic fertilizer, then there should be a process of phasing in. However, the government's ban came into effect overnight and without any consideration of the country's food supply. In June of last year, a group of 30 food security and farming experts informed the government of the substantial loss in harvest that could be seen should the ban not be reversed. Here you can see a table that they drew up with the estimates of how much the harvest could fall as a result of this ban. It's safe to say that these concerns were ignored. In fact, they were even suppressed. That's because a minister who criticized the policy earlier this year was dismissed from his post with immediate effect. Of course, you can see how all this played out. The ban had exactly the effect that the critics had predicted, and in some cases, it was even worse. For example, last year, the output of grain in the country fell by 43%. That's right, it almost halved. This meant that those Sri Lankans who ate rice now had to import that rice to make up for the shortfall. Remember that $400 million that the government wanted to save on the balance of payments? Well, to make up for the shortfall in rice, it had to import $450 million worth of it. Talk about shooting yourself in the foot. But if that was shooting themselves in the foot, then the impact on tea exports was blowing a leg off. That's because tea was one of the country's most stable exports and foreign currency earners. Exports totaled $1.3 billion, and Sri Lanka was responsible for about 5% of all global tea production. It turns out that the tea farmers were also quite dependent on fertilizer. Who would have thought it? So, tea production has fallen by an estimated 18% in Sri Lanka, down to its lowest level in over 23 years. Now, the impact of the ban on synthetic fertilizer has also not been uniform across the country. Some places have been hit harder than others. For example, in Rajanganaya, where most farmers operate only a small plot of land, many told The Guardian that they had seen a reduction of 50 to 60% of their harvest. According to farmer Vimukti De Silva, quote, "Before the ban, this was one of the biggest markets in the country, with tons and tons of rice and vegetables. But after the ban, it became almost zero. If you talk to the rice mills, they don't have any stock because people's harvest dropped so much. the income of this whole community has dropped to an extremely low level. Now, this, of course, points to another issue. Not only has the ban impacted on the food supply of the whole country, but it's also hit the incomes of hundreds of thousands of small farmers. Those who were least likely to be able to switch to organic fertilizers, even if they wanted to. These farmers have now decided that, given that they can't get much from their fields, they're going to abandon them entirely. By some estimates, this could result in a further 50% fall in rice production this year. This entirely predictable fall in the production of food in Sri Lanka is perhaps the reason why the government decided to reverse the fertilizer ban. In an interview with Bloomberg News earlier this year, the president even admitted that it was rolled out too quickly. Of course, that did little to quell public anger. The food and fuel crisis tore open old wounds and the protests intensified. They even breached the presidential palace, which led to dramatic scenes such as this. President Rajapaksa fled the country, first flying to the Maldives and then on to Singapore. He resigned while in exile, emailing his resignation to the country's parliament. We can be pretty sure that he, as well as the likes of Ashraf Ghani, who fled Afghanistan, are going to be living the high life while poverty and strife remain in the countries they abandoned. That aside, the new president has just been elected, and he is, well, the ex-prime minister. This was not something that many people wanted to see, and it further adds to the frustration at a status quo that appears to be entrenched in many governments around the world. And speaking of the current Sri Lankan Prime Minister, something else I found interesting is that he wrote a blog post on the World Economic Forum's website back in August of 2018. Quote, "This is how I will make my country rich by 2025. That, as they say, hasn't aged well. Fantasy predictions aside, the new president is going to struggle to regain control and restore a semblance of normality. Firstly, he predicts that the food crisis is likely to last well into 2023, and even then, I think that's an optimistic timeline. The government also has to sort out its finances, and it seems that here it is going to have to sup with the devil. That's because Sri Lanka is trying to secure a bailout from the International Monetary Fund, or IMF. If you've never heard of the IMF and what it does, then my video on the topic is well worth watching. That will be in the description. Now, the IMF is actually quite busy at the moment, as it's also engaged in negotiations with Pakistan over another debt deal. Hey, loan shark's got a loan shark, right? Anywho, back in June, the IMF was in Colombo for talks with Sri Lanka's government. The delegation left without a deal being sealed. That's because there are a number of things that need to be agreed by the government before a bailout can be given. For one, there's the question of whether Sri Lanka can actually pay the funds back. And if so, will it implement the reforms that the IMF stipulates? Those who have had to live under IMF reforms in the past will know exactly what these could be like: specified limits on fiscal deficits and surplus, which could further damage economic growth. There's also an understanding that the country needs to work with global bondholders and bilateral creditors to whittle down that existing debt. And remember who is Sri Lanka's largest creditor? Yep, China. While official statistics show that China holds about 10% of Sri Lanka's debt, many claim that the number is actually closer to 20%. I'll link to this paper below, which gives a more accurate picture of Chinese lending in the country. What this basically means is that Sri Lanka won't be able to get out of its current crisis without China. China needs to agree to the debt restructuring plan, which is not its usual path of conquest. It prefers infrastructure as collateral. And it's not like Sri Lanka hasn't tried. According to what the ex-president said in June, it couldn't tap a $1.5 billion credit line from the Chinese and wasn't able to take out a $1 billion loan. Anywho, according to the new president, negotiations with the IMF are, quote, nearing conclusion, and discussions with donor countries are also progressing. Let's hope, for the sake of the Sri Lankan people, that they're able to come to some sort of resolution.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Hey, it's Andy, Mike, and Jason of the Fantasy Footballers Podcast here, and we're inviting you to join us live on NFL Plus following the first round of the NFL Draft. Look, fantasy football, let's be honest, gentlemen, it kind of rules the world.
That's right, and we will be live with in-the-moment fantasy football reactions to all the first-round selections and all the craziest surprises. We never can predict what's going to happen on that first day of the NFL draft.
Lots of elite talent at the skill positions that will have a big impact on fantasy football this year. Are we going to get 3 wide receivers in the top 10? Are we going to break the record for the most wide receivers in the first round? Is there going to be a running back? I don't know.
And there's a lot of teams like the Chiefs, the Bills. We're really excited about their quarterback. Do they add a wide receiver? What are some of those best landing spots?
The Fantasy Footballers Draft Special will air exclusively on NFL Plus on Thursday, April 25th, following the conclusion of the first round of the draft. Go to plus.nfl.com to sign up today. Terms and conditions apply.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Okay, so there are many of you out there who are perhaps thinking, what does this have to do with me? Well, that's because today it may be a problem for Sri Lankans, but tomorrow it could be a problem for you as well. Firstly, there are a lot of countries that are in similarly precarious positions to Sri Lanka. Developing countries that mismanaged their finances and were wrecked by the pandemic restrictions. Countries that also have had food shortages and volatile politics. I just mentioned that Pakistan is getting a loan from the IMF, but there are also countries in the Middle East and Africa that are struggling too, countries that are historically unstable and prone to unrest. May I remind you that the Arab Spring, which kicked off in Egypt in 2011, was in part caused by a shortage of bread. Lebanon is going through unprecedented inflation and economic strife, and like Egypt, it's heavily dependent on wheat coming from Ukraine and Russia. As you will no doubt know, the war in Ukraine has left global wheat exports in dire straits. More about that in the description. The point is, when you have revolution and instability in these regions, it's hard to contain. People will leave their countries in search of employment and better prospects elsewhere. This leads to mass migration, which could further add to strife in other countries where resources are already stretched. Let's not forget the summer of 2015 in Europe. And speaking of Europe, the global food insecurity question is no longer just an abstract concept for the West. There are legitimate concerns in developed countries that they could soon be facing shortages. And if there's one thing that we've learned from Sri Lanka, it's that governments that try to implement idealistic environmental policies often do so without consultation with those who said policies impact. This is something that appears to be playing out in the Netherlands with the recent farmer protests. In this case, the government was trying to slash emissions of nitrogen oxide and ammonia by capping livestock farming. Of course, what happens if they get their wish and farmers reduce cattle numbers at the expense of food security? When do the protests start to involve more people than just farmers? Will a lack of food eventually lead to political revolution? Thankfully, though, unlike in Sri Lanka, Europe isn't facing a large-scale energy crisis, right? Now, I don't mean to pick on Europe, as it's clear that there are many regions facing economic challenges. Therefore, it's important to study the collapse of countries like Sri Lanka because it can be incredibly instructive as to how we avoid such disasters happening closer to home. I hope that this video was able to shed some light on that.
Thank you so much for listening to the Coin Bureau podcast. If you'd like to learn more about cryptocurrency, you can visit our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Coin Bureau. You can also go to coinbureau.com for loads more information about all things crypto. You can follow me on Twitter at Coin Bureau, all one word, and I'm also active on TikTok and Instagram as well.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Hey, it's Andy, Mike, and Jason of the Fantasy Footballers podcast here, and we're inviting you to join us live on NFL Plus following the first round of the NFL draft. Look, fantasy football, let's be honest, gentlemen, it kind of rules the world.
That's right, and we will be live with in-the-moment fantasy football reactions to all the first-round selections and all the craziest surprises. We never can predict what's going to happen on that first day of the NFL draft.
Lots of elite talent at the skill positions that will have a big impact on fantasy football this year. Are we going to get three wide receivers in the top 10? Are we going to break the record for the most wide receivers in the first round? Is there going to be a running back? I don't know.
And there's a lot of teams like the Chiefs, the Bills. We're really excited about their quarterback. Do they add a wide receiver? What are some of those best landing spots?
The Fantasy Footballers Draft Special will air exclusively on NFL Plus on Thursday, April 25th, following the conclusion of the first round of the draft. Go to plus.nfl.com to sign up today. Terms and conditions apply.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Awards Watch says Liam Neeson is at his best. Don't miss In the Land of Saints and Sinners. Having left his dark past behind, retired hitman Finbar Murphy, played by Neeson, leads a quiet life in a remote coastal Irish town. But when a menacing crew of terrorists arrive, Finbar is drawn into a vicious game of cat and mouse, forcing him to choose between exposing his secret identity or defending his friends and neighbors. In the Land of Saints and Sinners, from Samuel Goldwyn Films and Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. Watch it now on digital. Rated R.